Welcome to the first audio pod from the series of public lectures organised by World Rights London Behind the Scenes programme. This lecture is entitled The Making of the East End, and the speaker is Andrew Calcutt, programme leader of MA Magazines and MA Journalism and Society at UEL, and editor of Rising East, the online inquiry into the reconstruction of East London.
Well, what I've come to say is that when we talk about the making of the East End of London, we have to recognise that the making of the East End occurs and has always occurred elsewhere, because the East End of London is not and has not been a seat of power, so it can only, in modern times anyway, have ever been a result of conditions and forces and factors impinging upon and largely creating this area in their own image. And that is not to say that people living here are just automatons who do what these forces tell them, but it is to say that the making of East London in modern times has and continues to originate elsewhere, in places other than the one in which we find ourselves. And I want to back this up, to show this to you by means of a series of snapshots. Well, the turn of the 19th century, the turn of the 20th century, mid-20th century East London, and now the turn of the 21st. And what that amounts to is the turn of the capitalist class coming onto the stage of history and making modern history as we know it. The turn of the working class in their attempt to turn that history around. The mid-20th century, or the midpoint of the 20th century, where I would suggest the British capitalist class and the British working class turn in on each other in something like an embrace, at least a consensus anyway. And finally, a different kind of turn, a turn eastwards, production turning eastwards, and I don't mean to East London, I mean points much further east than that, to China and India, and the effects that that has locally on this East of which we're speaking. All of these turns have their origins elsewhere, other than in this neighbourhood. So, the turn of the 19th century, around 1800. The period before that, I put it to you, is one in which there's a vast expansion of trade on the back of the Thames. And the expansion of the range and the quantity of this trade has knock-on effects, has a ripple effect throughout the hinterland of what is in the process of becoming Britain. And these knock-on effects, these ripple effects, I would suggest, begin by working outwards from London to the rest of what is then becoming the British nation. But there comes a point where the ripples start working the other way. There comes a point where the expansion of trade on the back of the Thames provides the basis for something else happening in the rest of Britain. And the something else is the emergence of an industrial economy, the emergence of an economy which is not oriented towards local or regional production, but which is a new mode of production, and it has consequences for London, for the rest of the world, and in particular for the loading bay of what is becoming this new national industrial machine. And that loading bay is the London Docks, the 20-odd miles of loading and unloading down the banks of the Thames on both sides, which are, if you like, the formative experience of this first figuration of East London. But I'm pains to stress that what was a sequence of ripple effect originating from London outwards, the tide is reversed. And by the time we get to 1800, it's very much flowing the other way, so that there is the drawing together of this emerging national economy of production and the expulsion of products, of commodities, down the Thames through the Port of London, out to the rest of Britain by that route, and out to the rest of the world. And of course, the Port of London is also sucking in raw materials, sucking in people in order to keep this machine going. But what this means is that there are players in what I'm going to call the capitalist economy, players that are not often based in East London. And these players are calling into play this new mode of production and using East London, as I say, as a loading bay to get stuff in and out. And for that to occur, you need people to build the loading bays, the docks. You need people to operate them. You need people to service those operations and to service the people who do the operating. You need an expanding cluster, an expanding concentration of people in East London, but it's not of its own nature, right? It's not of its own local dynamic, not by this time anyway. It is an expression of a dynamic that is much more national and is funneling down to London and East London in particular as the route out, the route through which these commodities are propelled and expelled to the rest of Britain and to the rest of the world, and indeed raw materials and people sucked in to keep this industrial machine pumping. And the fact that so many goods shipped around the world had "Made in Britain" stamped on them was the making of this first figuration of the modern East End. And it's a figuration which I would like to suggest to you is characterised by expansiveness and inclusiveness and by instability, because it's a figuration that is all about things in motion. It's about bringing people in. It's about bringing goods in. It's about transforming labour and raw materials into things that never existed before and creating a world that never existed before on the back of this expanding, expansive machinery. A new society, in other words, a new society that is characteristically different from what preceded it because it didn't stay the same. And this is why we have, at the same time, on the fringes of what you might roughly call the East End, the birth of journalism, the birth of the production of news, because new things are happening at a rate and of a quality, of a character, that simply haven't happened like that before. I'm really suggesting here that the East End at this time is a concentrated rendition, a concentrated expression of this momentum, but it's a momentum that doesn't originate here. It is originating elsewhere and is flowing through and creating in its wake the first figuration of the East End of London, a secondary effect of this primary dynamic. And I want to invite you to think for a minute with me about what it means to produce things for the market, for a competitive market, for a market which is open, so that if you're a discerning consumer, you can choose between best and better, or not choose products that are worse. And if you're a producer, well, I'm a producer, you're a producer, he, she, it is a producer, we're in competition to set the standard, to produce goods that are better and are more likely to attract the equivalent goods in the form of money on the part of purchasers. And this is all about a disinterested, or this is the context in which there emerges a different kind of disinterested scrutiny of people looking at things, looking at objects in a way that you wouldn't have done if you'd been a patron who had an artist or a shoemaker more or less tied to your pre-modern feudal social order. And that shoemaker or that artist would be your artist and would be in a direct relationship with you and would produce things for you and for your eyes only. There is in this open market, I'm suggesting, an openness to a disinterested, impersonal kind of scrutiny. And people apply this scrutiny as purchasers, and they apply this scrutiny in their role as producers too. And it's an impersonal gaze upon goods primarily, but it doesn't take very long before people are looking at other people with the same disinterested, impersonal scrutiny. looking at people in the same way that they also look at manufactured goods. And I say disinterested, of course it's also self-interested, isn't it? It's about, you know, what's good for me, but it's also disinterested in that what's good for me is in accordance with and is against a measure of the industry standard. It's an intersection of self-interest with social standards of what are the best products of the time and what is the optimum achievement of this expansive society that I've previously begun to describe. So I'm talking about an impersonal gaze applied to people and applied to objects, and a gaze in which, if you like, the relationship between objects, the comparison of one object, one commodity against another, is the way we look at each other, the way that people of this time are looking at each other in this impersonal, disinterested kind of way, which also, as I say, happens to coincide with their private self-interest. As I've begun to say, they don't just do this in respect of objects, of manufactured goods, of commodities. They do it to each other, and they do it over objectivity itself. Because this way of looking at things and way of responding and acting to and from each other is, I think, the onset of objectivity. And there's a competition about who has the industry standard when it comes to knowledge. There's a competition about who has the industry standard when it comes to social policy. And when you get that competition in the context of impersonal relations between people who don't directly know each other but are brought together in the expansive movement of this society, when you get competition about who's right and who's going to implement the knowledge and the policy that claiming is the social standard, the industry standard, well, I'll call that politics. And I would say that that occurs in the public sphere, the creation of a capitalist class, a bourgeoisie, if you like, who, as I say, have already made such an impact on the East End of London, have made it in their own image as a kind of compressed version of their own expansive society. And so these impersonal relations and the look of people in these impersonal political relationships to and from one against and one with another, I think these are invented by a capitalist class who move westwards actually in order to implement them. Because the capitalist class that is visible on the dockside, and then secondly in the coffee house a bit further west than the docks, which mainly report what's going on in the docks, well, then it moves even further west to Westminster and Whitehall and to the establishment of the political relations characteristic of the capitalist class. And where does that leave people in the East End? Well, really it leaves them as something like cloakroom attendants to in a nightclub which is devoted to the social life of things. Because this is a context in which commodities, things that people have produced, have a social life. They go round the world. They have social intercourse one with another. They are exchanged on the market. But people who produce them and the people who load them in and out are stuck there. And it leaves the East Enders out of it once again, in that the political relations which I'm suggesting have developed as a continuation of these market relations and the mode of commodity production arising from it, well, they're not in those political relations either, yet. And that's the big thing. Because in the second half of the 19th century, the people in the East End of London demand to be let in to these political relations. They refuse to be shut out of this impersonal gaze through which has emerged not only a way of producing things, but also a way of developing and ordering society. And in their demands to be let in, they are in effect calling for the end of the East End. For the end of the East End as a working class ghetto, where people are only there to load stuff in and out and to be servants of these commodities that have a social life in a way that the mass of the population at that time didn't. Either they're calling for, at the very least, labour representation, for people who work to have their interests represented in these impersonal relations of politics, or they are calling for labour to be reconfigured altogether, so that labour ceases to be secondary to the social life of things and becomes the principal organiser of its own society. So either they're calling for the end of the East End as a working class ghetto, calling for East London to be included in the first capital city of capitalism, or else they're calling for capitalism and its capital city to be reconfigured altogether in their image rather than the image of the capitalist class who'd in the first instance established it in its modern figuration. Chartism is perhaps thought of as being the first instance, the charter for working people to get the vote. And that movement peaks in the middle of the 19th century. By the end of the 19th century, there is a turn more towards workplace-oriented workers' organisations and unions, and out of that, the representation of unions and their members, first in the form of the Labour Representation Committee, subsequently rebadged and re-equipped as the modern National Labour Party. I'm a bit wary of saying this because it's a bit of a broad brush point to make. And I know nothing's ever as simple as this, but I would like to be clear, but I'd also hope I'll avoid being simplistic. I think at this time, such was the expansiveness of the capitalist society, and such was the expansiveness of this emerging working class politics, that relatively speaking, people coming into London didn't take that long to become part of it. Whether you were coming into London from Yorkshire or Wales or Scotland or from Europe, so whether you were Jewish or from France, Huguenot, well, that's earlier. But look, the gist is this, that I think there was enough openness at this time, enough expansiveness, for there to be, by modern standards anyway, a streamlined intake of people from outside being incorporated, integrated in these fairly new impersonal relations of politics, and certainly new to working class organisation and working class expression of them. And exciting times, I think, and unstable times, and times of high hopes, where there is this combination of the instability that I previously mentioned, the inclusiveness, the intelligence that begins with a kind of market intelligence, the scrutiny of the consumer and the scrutiny of the producer producing for an open market, and is subsequently translated into the impersonal relations of politics, and the point at which those impersonal relations of politics are no longer monopolised by a ruling class, but are bust wide open by a working class that is determined at this point to end the peculiarity of the East End, to end the lifetime of the East End as a working class ghetto, to either, at the very least, to make it fully a part of the metropolitan capital of capitalism, or to turn the whole show around. And I think this moment of expansiveness and of conflict is characteristic of this second configuration of East London that I'm dating around 1900. Fast forward then to war, with the docks as the loading bay of British capitalism. Well, of course, if there's a war on, they're going to be under attack, aren't they? And I think I've already suggested the way in which politics is the continuation of economics by other means. Well, I'd also like to suggest that war is the continuation of politics by other means. And one way of characterising what happened in East London and elsewhere in Britain during the Second World War which some people would date as far back as the beginning of the Spanish Civil War, but the customary dating of it is 1939 to 1945. I think it's plausible to characterise this war as a displacement of class conflict between capitalist class and working class to international conflict. And again, that displacement takes place under a leadership that is based in the West End of London, but with lieutenants who live and work and operate in the East End. To use the kind of concepts that I've been using there before, I'm going to suggest to you there is a continuation of these indirect relations that originated in a market economy and are visible in a different form in politics, and are visible again in the experience of war, and are then visible in the aftermath of war, in the falling back to something like politics. You see, what happened when East End Labour and its representation joined up for the Second World War is that East Enders, all of them in effect, became rank and file soldiers, rank and file trade unionists, rank and file council tenants, rank and file users of what later became, not very much later, the National Health Service. And over and above the quite large number of individuals who literally, directly had all these experiences successively, there's an association set up between these in which they're all hinged together. So being a trade unionist who votes Labour, and being the kind of person who would fight for Britain against fascism, and being a council tenant, and being entitled to public health and something like public housing, that is a triangulation that is established in East London in the middle of the 20th century. But it's established, again, by West Enders for East End consumption, for East End benefit. And there were benefits, but there's a downside. There's a limitation involved. There are strings attached. And one way of understanding these strings, I think, is to say to you that these impersonal relations that I've characterised as being associated with politics were diminished in this setup, so that your East Ender was meant to vote Labour now and again and be a not particularly active member of a trade union, and was meant to enter into these impersonal relations insofar as those were the relations operating at work. But other than that, they were meant to be domestic. And there was, if you like, a kind of cult of domesticity promoted by the establishment at the time. It wasn't just women who were sent back from the factories to be housewives. Men in the factories were sent back out of politics to a more domestic kind of existence, which actually didn't sit very well with being in the East End, which is why so many people wanted to move out to a suburban kind of life, which does actually sit better with this more domestic mode of living. And another way of putting this is to say to you that in the Second World War, British capitalism had to be at its most expansive. And in doing so, it showed itself to be terribly overstretched and had to rely, both during the war and after it, on the Americans, and during the war on the Soviet Union too. And in the post-war period, I would suggest to you that British capitalism is characterised by a retraction. And there's a retraction on the part of British capital, and this is represented just like the expansion was 150 years earlier, or for the previous 150 years. This is represented in East End life too. So I think the working class of the East End in the post-war period start behaving less and less like a class, and more in line with a script that's more or less written for them again in the West End. And it's a script that has its origins in the West End, in Westminster and Whitehall, and even points further west, in Washington and Los Angeles, as the USA takes on the mantle of being the guarantor of capitalism worldwide. And there's an unfortunate coincidence in all this, which is probably sounds a trivial way of putting it, but it's not. And that is that in drawing in its horns, British capitalism drew in lots of its former imperial subjects. And they arrived in the East End at just the time when the Britain itself, and the East End in particular, was becoming more insular than it had been throughout modern times. And the experience of this new influx of immigrants was of being excluded from this inward turn because, you know, wrong time, mate, sorry. In effect, they were getting here just at the time when British capital as a whole, and the East End in particular, was closing ranks in accordance with Britain's diminished role in the world. I think in the recent period, in and around the turn of the 21st century, East London has again been forced to turn outwards. The Port of London moved its operations downriver to Tilbury, and this was a signal. It's not the only indication, but signal of the deindustrialisation of the region. But there were people who saw an opportunity in all these empty warehouses and moved in to invent what subsequently been described as live workspace. And I'm talking about the influx of artists and applied artists who moved eastwards from West London, from the art college mindset that might have been in Ealing or the Slade or Hornsey, and moved in on the east and have an effect in broadening the local mind and pushing the East End once again outwards. But it wasn't just the docks that were de-industrialised, it was Britain as a whole. Britain no longer playing that industrial role that it more or less invented. And I think in the run-up to the turn of the century, we find that the role of Britain in the world economy is actually much more like the role of the East End docks that are no longer there. Insofar as, if the docks were cloakroom attendants to the social life of things, what Britain mainly does now, in its key position in the global economy, it's cloakroom attendant for the social life of capital.
This audio pod was produced by WorldRight's London Behind the Scenes programme. For further audio and video pods from the series, and for more information about WorldRight's other projects, please go to www.worldright.org.uk.